Welcome to the Better Birth Podcast. My name's Erin and I'm a hypnobirthing and antenatal instructor, birth activist and all-round birth geek. In this podcast, I chat to experts in the field of pregnancy and birth, debunking myths around birth, diving into the research around maternity care and exploring what is it that means you're more likely to have a positive birthing experience. If you enjoy this podcast, do feel free to buy me a coffee and fund my caffeine habit. Link to my Buy Me a Coffee page is in the podcast info. Enjoy this episode. Welcome to Better Birth Podcast. Today, I am very pleased to welcome the wonderful Hazel Keedel, who is a midwife and researcher. She's also a senior lecturer at Western Sydney University, and she's done a PhD on women's experiences of planning VBACs in Australia. She's also the author of Birth After Caesarean, Your Journey to a Better Birth. And the other book that she's authored is The Journey of Home Birth After Caesarean, Fighting the System or Birthing in Peace. So obviously we're going to be talking about VBACs, which I think lots and lots of people really struggle with, I think, achieving. So I'm really appreciative of you agreeing to come and talk today, because it is a topic that I think needs to be talked about more. So why did you decide to do your PhD on VBACs? What kickstarted your whole journey, because you've really focused on VBACs as a topic, haven't you?
Yeah, I have. So I was a midwife and then became a mother, and I had a unplanned cesarean, and then very quickly, which was a planned home birth, but then an unplanned cesarean, and very quickly got pregnant with number two, and I was realizing that there was going to be a short interpregnancy interval between the cesarean and the next birth. So I was doing some reading and learning about VBAC, and then I decided to really go for it and have a VBAC anyway. And it was a bit of a fight, and I had to fight the system, even though I was part of the system as a midwife. And then after my VBAC, I was left with a couple of questions, really. Like, I felt amazing. And I felt healed, and I wanted to know, was I the only person that felt amazing, or was it just because I was a bit of a birth nerd and midwife? But I just wondered, how could any other woman achieve a VBAC when I'd had to fight so hard for one? And I did know my stuff, and they did know that I was a midwife, and even then that was still a battle. And I just, you know, I just wondered, how does any other woman do this? So after a little while, I started looking at doing research, and I bumped into Professor Hannah Darlin, and she was encouraging me to do research. And then I started my master's honours, which was about home birth after caesarean. And actually that second book is actually a book chapter in a bigger book called Birthing Outside the System, and which is edited by Professor Hannah Darlin and Barshi Hazard and Professor Virginia Schmid. And they asked me to write a chapter in that book based on my master's stuff. So I did. I wrote about why women choose to have a VBAC at home. And as soon as I finished my master's, I just wanted to know more. And I wanted to find out what it was like for women planning a VBAC across Australia, regardless of birth location or model of care. And so that's why I went into that PhD.
Oh, that's amazing. And it must have been eye-opening, I suspect, when you're doing that research and gathering people's experiences. So what kind of things did you discover? Like, what kind of barriers were people coming up against when they were trying to achieve an HVAC or a VBAC?
So I got the answers to my questions, which were, did more women feel amazing and healed and fantastic after their VBAC? And the answer to that was yes. And one of my favorite questions I would ask when I was interviewing women who'd had a HVAC was, how did you feel after your VBAC at home? And women would just do this big intake of breath, and you would just see the light come out of their face, and they'd be like, I felt amazing. I felt like superwoman. I felt so healed. And so that answered my question for that one. And I guess in my PhD, I was then able to explore, you know, what are the barriers and how does anyone else actually achieve that? And I found that women really go on the journey, and the journey from pain to power. That's one of my papers, where the pain is that previous cesarean and then the power is that VBAC. But I did initially think it was all about the vagina. I thought it was all about pushing a baby out through your vagina. And certainly that's a major part of it. But I think the more that I learn from women and from following women through their journey and then interviewing them and then doing a national survey, was it's actually more than that. It's actually how women feel after their experience. And that's where I learned about these four different factors, and I tested them in a national survey. And then that's what I wrote about in my thesis, but also then in my book, that yes, the VBAC is amazing, but we can't guarantee that women are going to have fantastic vaginal births either, because there are other things such as birth trauma and obstetric violence that is out there. And a cesarean can actually be a very healing experience as well. So that's where I learned a bit more. I went in there maybe a little bit naive, and I came out a lot wiser and learning about what these four factors that actually were pivotal to how women felt.
It's so true, isn't it? And I think it's true regardless of how you plan to give birth. It's that feeling of control and feeling involved in the process of planning your birth and you know, being involved in the process of birth, I think, that really does achieve that positive experience. Because a C-section in itself is not always a really traumatic negative thing, is it? It can be really powerful and really positive.
Yeah, so when we look at birth trauma, and I've now since, I mean, there was a lot of birth trauma that came through my PhD, but then also in the work I've done since as a early career researcher, and we have explored, you know, birth trauma, and we've explored obstetric violence, that a lot of the trauma is to do with the interactions with the healthcare providers and their attitudes and their beliefs, even down to whether they even honor vaginal birth, if they even think that vaginal birth is important or not. And all those little interactions throughout the pregnancy and then labor and birth and postnatally impact how women feel about that experience. Certainly, I'm not downgrading how women felt after their VBAC, because that was kind of like another level. And it is so amazing. And I can certainly, you know, vouch for that. It was a very empowering experience. And in my book, I've got 15 stories of women across the globe who had VBACs, but they had extra things that were complicating it, I guess. And again, that, you know, that triumphancy comes through their stories. But it's also recognizing that actually the, you know, those four factors of having control, having confidence, having an active labor, and having a respectful relationship with your healthcare provider, they are the most pivotal points.
I hear so many of my clients who have had previous C-sections really struggle with achieving or getting their midwife or their consultants on board with, and I'm doing air quotes, right, but podcast people can't see, kind of allowing them to have a VBAC, an HBAC, which is home birth after cesarean, even harder. And quite a lot of people get told off right from the start that a home birth is, you know, off the cards. There is no way you can have a home birth because you've had a previous C-section. So how do you think someone can navigate that? Because it must be really hard if you've got a professional telling you that it's really risky. The risk of scar rupture is a real risk. If it happens when you're at home, for example, then God forbid, you know, worst case scenario, you could die, the baby could die. I think that's very hard to kind of ignore or kind of go, okay, yes, I accept that, but this is what I want to do, and kind of push forward and push ahead with and to try and achieve what you want. So how can somebody navigate that? Because it seems like all of the, you know, everybody's kind of against that choice that you want to make.
Yeah, absolutely. And on that journey, there are positive things that can happen and people that you can meet. And then there's also the negative side as well. And we've got to pull apart some of that, because when we get told by clinicians that if you do this, your baby will die, that it's actually quite far from the statistical truth, right? So, you know, there's always that chance.
Yep.
But there's also always that chance anyway in any pregnancy. So whether you've had a previous cesarean or not. And actually what's going on in, I would say, most of that language is it's coercion. And
yeah.
We're a lot more familiar, I think, with the terms of coercion and coercive control now. And I actually think healthcare providers need to really consider the language that they're using, because what else are you trying to do other than get the woman to do what you want them to do? It takes away their choice and their control completely. They've got no control. And it's very difficult to turn around and go, all right, well, I don't believe you, and I'm willing to take that risk, because that makes you a bad mother. Like, that, you know, how can you say that? You're pushed into a corner. So it makes it very difficult to stand up. So first of all, we need to realize, actually, the fact that we've even got a term for it, the dead baby card, using that isn't okay. In the majority of cases, it's not actually okay to do that. And then the next thing is that knowledge is power. And that was a theme that came out of so many of the qualitative work, or the research that looks at the feelings and experiences of women, is that knowledge is power. And often women who are on their subsequent pregnancy and their VBAC journey, they realize that maybe they didn't know as much as they were hoping that they, or thought that they knew, with their first. And that first has become, they can look back and reflect. And the more they learn about physiological birth and the more they learn about VBAC, they actually realize they were really quite duped last time as well. Or maybe told things that they look back and go, really, was that true? Like, was that really the case? But then planning a VBAC, you just hit all these hurdles. And those hurdles are people saying whether or not you should be allowed to do something, and trying to use knowledge against women by saying the risks are very high. And, you know, if you do this, and looking at birth locations and saying that that makes it more risky. So, yeah, the knowledge is power. And so women need to get that knowledge. And I kind of really broke it down in my book and talked about what uterine rupture is, what the risks are to uterine rupture, and actually, really importantly, what are the outcomes to uterine rupture. So there was this really big study in 2019. And the great thing now is I see on some of these social media sites actually people using that study, because I put it in the book. And they not only did they work out the rate, which was 0.22%, but then actually what happened to the mothers and the babies who did have uterine ruptures. And 90% of babies survived them, and 99% of women survived them. So actually the thought of saying, you know, if you have a VBAC, your uterus will rupture and you and your baby will die, is not cause and effect. You just really can't say that when the numbers are not actually showing that. When we're looking at location, for example, so place of birth, a lot of women were actually choosing, in the study that I did, a lot of women were choosing home birth not actually because of the location, but because they were going to the hospital and saying, well, last time I had all these interventions and they led to the cascade of interventions and I had a cesarean. So this time I don't want to be induced and I don't want to have an epidural and I don't want this. And that's actually okay. Women are smart and can figure it out. And actually it's all right to say no to things. But then they'd get the pushback. They'd get that dead baby card. They'd say, we have to do this. And you know, you're not allowed to not want to have those interventions. And then women voted with their feet and walked out and had a look at what else was out there. And they would often then call a private midwife. And we have privately practicing midwives in Australia that offer home birth. And they might call the home birth midwife, and that's the first time they've ever had a yes. Mm. That's the first time they've ever had someone say, I believe in you. And I believe in VBAC. And that's probably because private midwives see VBAC a lot. And I was a private midwife for many years too. And we see the joy and the, how it changes the woman and her family. in that uninterrupted healing space of home. So, you know, it wasn't always a first choice for women, but actually women are smart enough to be able to look at the statistics, look at the place of birth statistics, and we do have good numbers on that, and decide whether or not that's a risk they're willing to take. It's actually their risk, not the healthcare provider's risk. And at the end of the day, that clinician is not going to go home and care for your baby. It's actually the woman that does that, who then becomes a mother for the second, third, or subsequent time, and needs to be in the best space that she can be to care for that baby and the family and continue being a mum, which is one of the most challenging jobs in the world. And so really, if the woman is happy to understand the risks and go, you know what, I'm going to make the decision for me, well, then the healthcare provider should respect that. There should be no allowing. It should be, okay, do you understand? Can we go through that together? You do understand and you're happy with that? Then I'll support you.
Yeah. That's the issue, isn't it? And it's why books like yours are so important, because quite often people aren't told those statistics. You know, I know lots of people who go into those consultant appointments and they don't get given those statistics, or they receive information in a skewed, biased manner, which happens quite a lot. You know, your risk is increased sixfold, but then they don't give the absolute actual figures behind that increase, which makes it sound terrifying. Or I've had one client told to go and Google the statistics because the consultant didn't have them. And you kind of wonder, well, how can you be doing your job properly if you're telling people there's a risk and you can't quantify that risk and you don't know what the research is and what the things you're saying is based on? It's immoral. So it's good that there are people like you who are putting that information and that research out there so that people are armed with that knowledge. I mean, I didn't realize, I knew that the risk of scar rupture was 0.22%, but I didn't realize that the outcomes were so good even with scar rupture, which just shows how little, you know, people realize that the actual risk. Like, my math is rubbish, but if we calculated that out as like an absolute risk, it would be minuscule, you know, for the worst outcome, which is the one that is being dangled in front of people when they say they want a VBAC. I find that mind-blowing that we are told not to do something about
that it's going to be this, you know, catastrophic event. Now, that doesn't mean that those are not going to happen, because we can never say that. Mm-hmm. But actually, when you look at the risk of having your baby pass away from stillborn, it's about the same. Mm-hmm. And so even if it wasn't because of a previous cesarean, there's always going to be that. We know that. We, as midwives, we care for women that have had stillborns, and we never know the outcomes. And it is awful and it's terrible, or neonatal deaths during the birth or shortly afterwards. So we know as healthcare providers that we can never guarantee 100% either way. But to then just say to conflate those risks, that's not right, and to use it in a coercive manner or in a way that makes them the gatekeeper of what type of birth you can have, when what I do know from my actual research was that VBAC, or a positive birth after cesarean, it was never a full stop. It had such an impact, you know, a woman having a VBAC, or her the positive birth that she was planning, and she felt that she was in control of her choices and her wishes and the outcome, and she had confidence in her ability, but also her healthcare provider's ability their confidence in her having a vaginal birth, had a good relationship based on trust and equity, and had the opportunity to be as active and upright in labor and birth that she wanted. God, the ripple effects are just endless. And I would see that. I mean, my ripple effect is to get here now and today and to do all this work and get this out to women. But I would hear this all the time. Every time I would do a conference presentation, I'd have people come up and tell me about their own VBAC or ones that they've been part of. And women would come up to me and find me on social media and share what they've done. They would become doulas afterwards. They would become midwives. Mm-hmm. And in my book, there are three stories from women, and each one of them was a current student in the Bachelor of Midwifery that I teach. So one was in first year, second and third year. That's now second year, third year, and a new grad. And they all came to midwifery because of their vaginal birth after cesarean. And then they shared that in their book as well. So actually, if we start looking at the benefits of VBAC and the benefits of a better birth after cesarean, we're going to make such a difference to other women. Sometimes it's just being that one voice in a social group that, you know, just makes a difference. Like, you know, they can't tell you this, or, you know, what about, have you thought about this? It can just be that one person. It can be all the way through to a friend that I lost contact with. And when my book came out, he contacted me to tell me about the VBAC experience him and his new wife had and how it impacted them. Like, it makes such a big difference. I wish we focused more on that mm-hmm. than we did on, you know, deciding whether or not women can have a certain type of birth, which is just crazy. It's almost as ludicrous as deciding whether women can birth in water. For goodness sake, it's a bath full of water. It doesn't even have bubble bath in it. Like, what are we doing saying women can't get into a bath? Like, next time you have a bath, Erin, like, make sure that you sign your consent form and send it in. And like, it's some of the things we do, I feel like we're always having to, in our research, a lot of the time we're having to prove that vaginal birth is okay, and actually the physiological birth is what women want and actually experience and benefit from. It's a little bit crazy at times.
It's funny because every time a new research study comes out, I don't know if you've seen, there was an Irish study that I put on my Instagram quite recently, it was this week, showing women's birthing people's experiences of home birth versus hospital birth.
Oh yeah.
Like, none of this is revolutionary, right? It's not like, oh my god, my mind's blown. Like, we all know that people have better outcome, better experiences birthing at home versus hospital. But it, again, it's like, it's almost like it seems we need to do the studies to give the hard facts and the evidence and the statistics so that people can literally go armed with them into an appointment and go, well, there is evidence to show that what I'm asking for is not that risky and actually has better outcomes. And so this, can you support me in achieving what I want to achieve from my birth?
And the fact that we need to arm women with this knowledge is, I mean, it's great that we can do it, and it's important that we do. It's obviously a real passion of mine, but also, like, you almost have to kind of be one step ahead. I mean, I did some videos a few years ago, and I must repost them because they're all still valid. And one of them was about little animated videos looking at the studies that were out there at the time on multiple cesareans and vaginal birth after multiple cesareans. And I remember one woman contacted me and saying that she'd had it saved on her social media, and during the appointment she made the obstetrician watch the video and then try and come back and say that she shouldn't have a VBAC after two cesareans. Yet still I see stories, you know, especially on the Australia VBAC groups, where women are threatened by the healthcare providers because, or being told that nobody in the whole of this state will approve you, will support you to have a VBAC after two cesareans, when even, you know, the American College of Obstetricians and Gynecologists suggest that VBAC after two cesareans is safe in most cases. Mm. So it's tricky that we have to keep, you know, getting this information to women so that they can be armed. But it's also tricky because it's not an equal power relationship. So it's very difficult to then go into that appointment, and especially during labor, to then have to fight. We shouldn't be using that part of our brain when we're in labor. And that's why I think it's really important to highlight the impact of models of care on women planning a VBAC. And there was another study actually that just came out recently from Canada, actually written by a friend of mine. So I contacted her because I haven't spoken to her for a while, Dr. Catherine Stoll. And we used to be conference buddies traveling around before pre-COVID. And she looked at the different models of care with continuity of care with a midwife and then GP shared care and obstetric care. And I'm so glad that they put VBAC in, that they looked at the outcomes for VBAC. And the VBAC rate, so the women that planned a VBAC and then had a VBAC, were in the 80s% compared to the other models of care, which was sitting around about 60s and 70s. Now, we've seen that before, but actually to show that this continuity of midwifery care had higher VBAC rates is really, really important. Mm-hmm. And the impact of model of care, when I did that for my national survey, is the paper I wrote about it, I compared continuity of care with a midwife, continuity of care with a doctor, which over here in Australia is generally with a private obstetrician, and then the standard fragmented care where you're likely to see whoever. And that's about 40% of women in Australia kind of have that standard care. And what I found was women that had continuity of care with a midwife, they felt more in control. They had better confidence in themselves, but their midwives also displayed that confidence. They had a relationship that was based more on trust and equity rather than that hierarchical relationship. And they were much more likely to be upright and active in labor and more likely to have a water birth. Now, we had quite a few women have home births after cesarean, so I think that might have also increased our water birth rate there. But yeah, like it was just a no-brainer that actually choosing the model of care that had that continuity and that continuity with the midwife had that better outcomes.
Yeah. And this is why it's so heartbreaking, I think, like for the UK, we know we have a midwifery crisis. We know that hospitals are understaffed and therefore continuity of care is practically non-existent because we don't have the midwives to be able to facilitate that continuous care with the same midwife all the way through. But I also think then it's important for people to consider, for example, a private midwife, an independent midwife, if it's something, obviously not everyone can afford that because, you know, it comes with a cost and the NHS is free. But it comes with huge benefits. You know, we know, like you said, seeing the same person all the time rather than seeing different people and having to re-explain and possibly re-justify your choices every time you go to an appointment and speak to a different person is soul destroying when you're pregnant and you want to be excited and you want to be enjoying your pregnancy and you have this constant, you know, anxiety and stress over, am I going to get the birth that I really, really want? Because you're getting so much pushback from multiple different people.
Yeah, it's so challenging that fragmented care doesn't work. And I know that, you know, in the NHS, you know, whenever there are crises of you know, workflow and numbers of midwives, those continuity of care programs, those publicly funded home birth programs, they get scrapped just to make sure that you've got enough midwives on the floor. We're lucky here in Australia that most of our states and territories and all of our health is run through our different states and territories, not through the national government or federal, as we call that, that they have an agenda to increase continuity of care models. And I'm in New South Wales, so where Sydney is, and, you know, we have some amazing continuity of care models that are springing up or have been there for a long time and are expanding. We've got them in regional locations as well, but it's not across the board. And we know that because our Australian Bureau of Statistics actually looked at models of care and it was lower, the amount that actually did get to see. I think it was something like less than 20% who actually do get to have that continuity of care with a midwife. There was some real effort to increase them, but there's always pushback, you know, and that pushback is, again, we don't have the staffing or they're poorly managed models, which means midwives get more burnout. And, you know, so it's not easy. So it's worth, you know, it is worth women really thinking about, well, what else is out there for them? If they can't get continuity of care with a midwife, then there are other ways of getting that continuity of care benefit. And so that is certainly doulas, especially doulas that provide a good continuity of care beforehand. I do worry when there's more of a light service, so maybe only seeing somebody once or twice and then rocking up for their birth, because I think at that point you've only got what the doula's ideal birth is, not what the woman's ideal birth is. And you know, a lot of this relationship factor is because is stronger in midwifery, because midwives spend time in consultative care models. We even did a little bar graph that showed how much time they spent compared to fragmented and then consultative care with a doctor. And you need that time to build up that relationship. How can you really know? Bearing in mind as well that many women who have had a previous cesarean have a higher rate of birth trauma. So we normally see about a third of women, and in the recent study that I'm part of, we also saw that a third of women who have experienced a traumatic birthing experience. But when I asked that in the VBAC survey, so, and these were women that had planned a VBAC in Australia, I found there were two thirds of women that found their previous cesarean to be a traumatic birthing experience. So we've already got women with increased rates of birth trauma, and this, you know, the chance of them not being supported either. So you need that time to really go through that trauma, to go through what happened last time, and to make different plans for this time, which is both what kind of plan do you want for your VBAC, but if you need a repeat cesarean, what kind of plan do you want to make for that as well? And that takes time. And so I think if doulas are looking at this area, and there are some fantastic doulas, it can't be a light service. You can't get that in one session or two sessions. Like, you need to build continuity. The other area where we are seeing in our studies now, we're seeing women identify this as a benefit, and that's student midwives. So here in Australia, our student midwives have to follow through at least 10 women, and that's going to their appointments, being on call for the labor and birth, and going to them and then seeing them postnatally, offering that continuity of care model. And that's, we often see that's a bit of a bridge between the fragmented model, or maybe a model where they're not going to have the same person during labor and birth, and then they see their student midwife. Mm-hmm. So that can be, you know, something worth looking for. And we hear of women, you know, turning up to antenatal clinic and saying, is there a student available? Can I have a student midwife? And that's fantastic. And certainly as someone who trains the future midwives and has student midwives, I can vouch for them. They're absolutely amazing. So that could be something in the UK as well. I'm sure they'd have to follow through women as part of their training as well. And they're usually looking for women.
I don't know if students do follow people throughout their pregnancies. I'll have to find out, because I don't think it's a thing, but if it's not it should be, because it makes absolute sense that would be a really good experience for a student to build.
Yeah,
that
it's built into our accreditation standards for our midwifery education, so it's a vital part. And it's often a challenging part if you've got assignments and essays and exams, and then your own clinical block, and then you've also got women that you're caring for. But they would never want us to take it away. Like, that's their favorite bit, like the relationships. We do that both for our Bachelor of Midwifery, but also our Graduate Diploma of Midwifery, which are nurses who then do midwifery. And they have to do it in 16 months compared to the 3 years that the Bachelor of Midwifery get. And I had the last day with them recently, our Graduate Diploma of Midwives. And I went through at the end of the day, it was like last ever day in university, and I was covering for someone that, so I got to see them for the last day. And at the very end of the day, I said to them all, because I wanted them to leave on a positive note, because there's often a lot of, you know, they're witnessing a lot of stuff and there's a lot of negativity, and that's important. But on the last day, I thought, you've got to leave on a positive note. So I asked every single one of them to share one person that's been an inspiration to them throughout their training. And there were a lot of wonderful inspirational midwives, inspirational educators, but a lot of the women said they're CCE women, that during their tough times, knowing that they were going to turn up to that appointment, and they got to see a smiling face from the woman who was excited to have them there. One student midwife said that, you know, and she struggled through the course, really struggled to get through. And she said that her follow through women would just send her little messages and saying, you've got this, you can do this, and we believe in you. And like, they were pepping her up. And so they really invested in their student midwife. And like, that was, I'd never heard it from that point, and I was like, wow, that's really amazing. And certainly I can reflect on my experience as a continuity care midwife. There were certainly relationships up with women that really helped me through tricky times, because you develop that, you know, that strong relationship.
Oh, that's really lovely. That's really, really lovely. And it's, you know, you're right. It's a hard job being a midwife. You know, I'm not a midwife, but I know from speaking to other midwives that it is a really hard job. And, you know, some of the happiest midwives, I think, are people who work on home birth teams or work in continuity teams and are building those relationships and are not seeing kind of this conveyor belt of strangers coming through their clinic. So that makes absolute sense. And yeah, I really hope that student midwives in the UK do get to do that, because I'm sure it would make such a huge difference on their experiences while they're studying.
Yeah, I'll have to check in. I know some people in the UK. I can ask. Yeah.
So we mentioned scar rupture as a risk. And just before we finish, you mentioned right at the beginning when you were talking about your own VBAC, the fact that you had a short gap between pregnancies was something that potentially made it more tricky. So what other kinds of factors can increase risk? Again, I'm doing air quotes, with a VBAC. So obviously a small gap between pregnancies. Is there any other factors that, you know, you might get pushback for if you want a VBAC?
So when I was writing the book, I was including this kind of information in the statistics chapter, but it actually ended up becoming its completely own chapter called "Can I Have a VBAC If?" And I was looking at all the questions that I get asked on my social media page constantly, which I love getting. I love receiving them, and they would be, you know, can I have a VBAC if I've had multiple cesareans, if I've got twins, if I've got breech, short into pregnancy, birth location. So I went through them all and put them in the book so people can just look straight away to that and go, oh, okay, that's the most current research at the time of writing. But I, like, you know, there are a few things, but they never mean you've got 100% chance of having uterine rupture. Mm-hmm. So if they do increase it, they increase it just a little bit. So for example, when I was looking up my chance of having uterine rupture with a short interpregnancy interval, for which that was only 13 months birth to birth, but it would have been the interpregnancy interval was actually just only going to be 4 months. I couldn't believe it. I got pregnant 4 months after. That was not part of the plan. And I was reading a paper came out that year, actually, that my first baby was born in 2007. And what it did is it looked at uterine rupture rates and it did the cutoffs for the different types of interpregnancy interval. And the less than 6 months, which mine was, it went up to a whopping 2.7%. Now, I'd been spending the weekend reading all about these uterine rupture rates that varied to about 0.1 to 0.8, right? So less than 1% in the majority of cases. And suddenly I read 2.7%. I'm like, oh my goodness, 2.7%. I definitely can't do it. And I went out to my husband, who's a numbers man, and he actually does the numbers, the stats for us on our research projects now. And I went out to him and I went, I can't do it. I can't have a VBAC. And he's like, why not? And I said, because I've got a 2.7% chance of it happening. And he'd not been reading everything that I had. And he turned around and he went, what? So you've got a more than 97% chance of it not happening? He's like, it's more dangerous to get in your car and drive to the hospital to have your baby than it is to be planning a VBAC and worry about uterine rupture. And I was like, oh, yeah, that's right. But when we then say, if we put it in a different way, like you were mentioning earlier, and we say, well, that doubles your chance of having uterine rupture, then that does sound quite scary. But if we actually put it back to 2.7, and that was kind of the highest risk we could find, it's like, oh, what? And so other things that... So it's, you know, I'm probably not very popular when I think there's probably not a lot that really says that you can't go for a VBAC. Even if it does increase it, be aware what it increases it to. And are you comfortable with that? I was comfortable with that. I must say I avoided all antenatal care for the rest of my pregnancy, but I was a midwife, so I knew how to work the system. And I did it. And guess what? It wasn't catastrophic. She came out through my vagina and it was amazing. But there are other things that, you know, there's just blanket policies that you cannot do this, which is, for example, women who've got special scars. So that's anything other than the lower transverse. So maybe it's had an extension, maybe it's got a little vertical line, like an inverted T, maybe it's a J. There's a whole list of them, different types. It can even be a vertical scar, and it can even be a previous rupture. So there can be all these special scars, and there's an amazing website called Special Scars, Special Hope, and I put the link to it in my book as well. And they have a list of all the different ones, and they put a load of research on their website as well, and they have their own closed social media groups to support each other. And in Australia, anyway, the all the policies across Australia will just say, if you've got any of those scars, you have to have a repeat cesarean at 37 weeks. Yet, again, yes, it may increase the rupture rate, although I must say we don't have a lot of data on that because it's quite rare, a uterine rupture is quite rare. But it still doesn't mean 100%, and you're just blocking off all women from even exploring that. So in my VBAC survey, I actually had a cohort of women that had special scars, and half of them had a VBAC, but I know 100% of them would have had a fight. And one of the women in my qualitative side, who I followed her all throughout, she did recordings after every appointment for me in the app I developed, and then I interviewed her afterwards. She had, I think it was an inverted T scar. And the fight that she had was just crazy, from the first appointment being told that they'll close the hospital doors to her. She won't be able to walk in. I mean, it's a public hospital. Like, you can't actually do that. I don't even think a private hospital could get away with that. If there was a woman outside the doors pushing a baby out, what they would just close the doors to her. So they said that, which is, that's nothing more but coercion. Yeah. And then later on, sat her down with all the managers, like the managers of maternity, the managers of obstetrics, and all said that they didn't support her. They thought what she was doing was too risky, and then wrote a letter home signed by all the physicians saying, you should not do that. You should not do that. Now, she was on my research project, so not that they knew that. She was on my research project, so she shared all of that information, and she had to navigate that. And I think really what got her through was her amazing confidence in her own ability to do this that really drove through. And her story is in one of my papers, the narrative analysis one. And also, though, she found continuity of care with a midwife. That was a very brave midwife. I'll never know who it was because of confidentiality. And so she never shared that. But wow, I would have loved to have given her a hug one day, because I also know, being on that side of the fence, how challenging that would have been for the midwife too. And, you know, birthing, laboring in that hospital after they said they're going to close the doors and that none of you could do that, wasn't a safe space for her. She labored at home for as long as she could, and she turned up and 20 minutes later pushed a baby out of her vagina. Now, she learned about the risks. She was happy with them and then had to fight. And that's so much extra stress when we know about the impact of stress on our babies, of our unborn babies, that's, she was happy with her decision. So why couldn't everyone else? Why'd they have to put her through so much stress? Mm. So I'd really think, you know, I think we have to be very careful when we say things can't, because of that, you can't have, or it increases your risk. The other thing I just want to add to that as well is that the reasons where women maybe, you know, would need a repeat cesarean are reasons why they would need a cesarean anyway. So, you know, true reasons, like true emergency reasons, they're going to happen. And they may well still happen. You know, you could have a cord prolapse. You could have a placenta previa that covers the cervix, you know, things like that, where there were just there isn't, you know, really no other options. And that's fair enough. Those things happen. But if we're just saying it's because it increases your uterine risk, well, how much does it increase it to by? And how do you feel about that? And, you know, where does that fit with you, and what is it that you really want to do?
Yeah, it's so true that we should be, or I say we, I'm not part of the NHS, the NHS or the healthcare provider or the midwife or the consultant, you know, it is their job to inform and then support the decision that's made. You know, in every other aspect of our health, when we see a doctor and they write us a prescription for antibiotics, for example, it is down to us to decide whether we want to take that to a pharmacy and then take the pills. And if we don't, no one's going to tell us off because it's our choice. But when we're pregnant, all of that autonomy seems to just go out the window completely. And we aren't seen to be capable of making adult decisions about our bodies and our babies. And it's frustrating. It's really frustrating. And it's not just true with just VBACs, it's with everything. You know,
absolutely. It is. It's with everything. I think, you know, I was speaking to an obstetrician the other day who we were talking about and talking about collaborating with, and you know, she said something. She said, you know, just by being a first-time mum, you're a risk factor. Just yeah. Because you got pregnant for the first time, that's seen as a risk factor. I mean, if that doesn't show you that we've really screwed up when it comes to calculating risk in women, you know, regardless of if you've got any health issues or you're an athlete, the fact that the minute you get pregnant, you're seen as a risk factor, that to me is, you know, we've just got that wrong. We've just got that so wrong. Yeah. This is a normal physiological event that many women and birthing people go through, and we should be celebrating that, and we should be supporting that, because there are enough complexities just with our own mental health and social situations that come into it, rather than just, you know, looking at the fact that just because you're pregnant, you're a risk factor. You're not. You're going through something absolutely amazing, and usually whether or not you come out of that birth as an empowered woman ready to take on being a new mum, or whether you come out like a third of our women do, and in Australia 1 in 10 women experiencing obstetric violence, you come out traumatized, that's not down to you being a risk factor. That's usually down to how you're treated by healthcare providers. We've got a lot of work to do. It just shouldn't get to that point.
Yeah. So if somebody is planning a VBAC and they need to find you and all of your wonderful information, where can they find you online?
Sure. So the book is available in online, and in the UK you can get it through Amazon, I believe. I'm coming out actually in April, so I'll be getting out to a few other little places that I'm going to and speaking at a few events with midwives, so that's going to be quite exciting. I am actually originally from the UK. I've been out here 20 years.
Are you?
So yeah, I am. I'm going to say it right now, I'm a very proud Essex girl. I'm from Southend. I don't sound like that, but I am, and my family is still there, so I haven't seen them for 6 years. I'm very much looking forward to coming out in April to do that and to do work as well. But you can get it online, but you can also find me on Instagram under @HazelKeedle. You can find me on Facebook @HazelKeedle VBAC Researcher. And I share all the work that all the VBAC stuff or any podcast interviews I'll put up on there. And then also research that's coming out. So the most recent paper, paper but one that came out was all about obstetric violence. And I'm the lead researcher on the birth experience study, which is the largest maternity experiences survey we've ever done in Australia, with nearly 9,000 women. And we've now got that being done in 4 other countries as well. So it's quite exciting. So you get a lot of data coming out of me. A lot of papers are under review. So hopefully this year there's going to be a lot more coming out. Oh. And my specialization, other than VBAC, is actually women's experiences of maternity care. I think we can't design a service, we can't fix a service, we can't have the right healthcare service if we don't listen to our consumers, our women and our birthing people.
Mm. And you share lots of really amazing positive birth stories, VBAC birth stories on your Instagram as well.
I do. That started since my book came out, because women have been contacting me saying that they've read the book and then they had this amazing experience. And I was getting so many of them, I was like, well, I should start sharing those. And so I've then contacted them all and said, would you like to write up in more detail and show me a picture? And so I have been sharing them as they come out. And also any better birth after cesarean story. So it's not all VBAC. It could be a repeat cesarean. It can be birthing at home with or without healthcare providers. Like, you don't have to have read the book. You can share your previous story. And I've been getting good feedback from that as well. So yeah, send me. The last one I put on there was a woman from Ireland. So yes, they're from all over the world as well.
Oh, thank you so much for coming on and chatting. And I really hope people buy a copy of your book if they're planning a VBAC, because there's amazing statistics in there, and amazing information. And thank you for giving up your time for coming to chat.
Oh, it's been absolutely wonderful. Thank you for having me on.
The Better Birth podcast and all of its content is for educational and informational purposes only. You should consult your midwife or your doctor for anything in relation to your own pregnancy and birth. The opinions and the views of the guests on the Better Birth podcast are their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of Better Birth or Erin Fung.